morning, good afternoon, Arthur, brethren and sisters. As Brother Ewan provided the details for us last night, in the background we know that the circumstances of the times was the restored people of Israel from Babylon, or more correctly perhaps, the restored people of Judah from Babylon, and they were going to be engaged in building the temple and building the walls of Jerusalem. Though, as Brother Ewan indicated to us, there were delays on both accounts. But the actual work of building was something that would have naturally been very familiar to the people of Israel. That was the very purpose of their return initially, to get the temple built and to get the walls built around Jerusalem. That would have been their priority, so that they could have begun to concentrate on the everyday circumstances of worshipping Yahweh. So when we consider the visions of Zechariah, as Brother Ewan made reference to last night, and also Brother Matthew in his comments, the visions contained aspects which would have been very, very familiar to the people who had returned from Babylon. They would have made a ready identification with the visions. As was commented last night, the olive trees were probably there. And they would have certainly been carpenters. And Brother David has spoken quite extensively about the carpenters in the second vision that Zechariah was given in chapter 1. Brother David also referred to the measurements and a measuring aspect in the first chapter, when Yahweh said that Jerusalem was going to have a line stretched forth upon it. So when we come to chapter 2 and verse 1, Zechariah is introduced to another vision, or is given another vision, a third vision. I lifted up mine eyes, he says again, and behold, and looked, and behold a man with a measuring line in his hand. The people then, as well as Zechariah himself, would have been very familiar with that sight. It would not have been uncommon for Zechariah or any one of the people to have seen a man with a measuring line. This was perhaps quite different from the man among the myrtle trees, perhaps, and a little different even to the four horns and the four carpenters. Though the carpenters and the measuring line would have had that ready reference, as it were, to the building work that would have been engaged in at Jerusalem. It would have been a very familiar sight to have seen the skilled men going around the city holding instruments of length, or whatever instrument they might have used to actually measure things and build things, as each of us who have attempted to build anything knows, we are going to have to get an instrument to measure if we are going to build. So that we know what is the length of whatever we're going to build, and what is the breadth, and so on and so forth. So this vision would have been something the people could have identified with in a very real sort of way, and Zechariah himself. Because perhaps this vision, more than any other vision with this aspect of measuring, indicates the idea of labour, activity, work. Not just any labour and activity, not just any engagement of building, but a divine activity. This was building the things which related to God. Now, Brother Ewan provided us last night with a number of circumstances which would have made that work difficult, would have made that work cumbersome. We know the initial state of Jerusalem was burnt rubble. And we know that added to the natural difficulties of removing that rubble was the adversarial aspects, the people around them who did not want to see this work being pursued. And as Brother Ewan said last night, they were actually, for a period, a I think Brother Ewan said a period of 15 years, successful in preventing the development of this project. So labour is something which the people were engaged in. There was an incentive to get the temple built. There was an incentive to get the walls built. It's like any activity. We have to see the end before we start at the beginning. And the people here realised what they were labouring for. And I think Brother Ewan's exhortation last night was very, very useful. Yes, there was a lot of problems. There was a lot of rubble that had to be removed before the building work could begin. And there was a lot of opposition to that building which had to be overcome. But the vision that we are given shows that the best way to overcome those difficulties is labouring in God's work. Activity, not idleness, was the way that problems could be solved. So the people here then were given a vision which would have been able to encourage them, been able to stimulate them in the work at hand. And so when Zechariah, as we're not told the way that he would have done this, but he would have been given, no doubt, these visions, and he himself would have told the people in some sort of format or other what he had seen. Because we know in Ezra chapter 5 it says, "Then arose Haggai and Zechariah and got that work started again." So these visions were probably presented to the people to encourage them in that work of labour and activity in divine things. And I suppose that's really one of the values that we have in the scriptures, that in our labour and activity, we are given an incentive. We are given a purpose to continue our enthusiasm and our encouragement. We're given a vision. So that what we're trying to say is, as well as for the people in Zechariah's day, who were given a vision of encouragement, those same words which were presented to the people of Judah who had returned from Babylon are the same words of encouragement that can stimulate us in our building activity. So, as we were discussing actually before this present meeting, the words of Scripture are constructed in such a way that they can be seen in different lights and have a perspective which spans centuries as well as provide details for the contemporary individuals to whom it is initially given. So that for the people in Zechariah's day, they would be stimulated, or that was the design, by the vision that was given to them. And even though those words were spoken well over 2,000 years ago, those same living words are given for us. So that when we have difficulties, when we have problems, when we have oppositions, or whatever the difficulties might be, these same words of Scripture are able to strengthen and encourage. Because when we look at the vision that was given here in chapter 2, and as we say, we don't know how exactly Zechariah would have presented it to the people, there would have been a limitation as to the relevancy of the vision. By that I mean, Zechariah, when he sees the man with the measuring line, and the people would immediately have umpteen pictures of people going around Jerusalem with measuring lines, doing different tasks, because they weren't all waiting to see the same task being built. Some would have been working, like if we take Nehemiah, I know that was building the wall rather than temple, but if we take that as an example, there were people spread out all through the wall in their labours. So too in the building of the temple, there were probably people measuring everywhere. But when we come to look at verse 2, it says, "Whither goest thou?" And he said unto me, "To measure Jerusalem, to see what is the breadth thereof and what is the length thereof." So the vision of encouragement, and I think we have to see these visions as visions of encouragement for the people, would not have just said about, I'd seen a man with a measuring line, and one was measuring the door of the temple, another was measuring the base where the altar might go, another was measuring the length and breadth of the building itself. And Zechariah presents the picture to them that this man he had seen in vision was actually measuring Jerusalem. Now, that's a huge task. That's whatever instrument of measurement you have, to measure the city, the length and the breadth thereof, it takes it out of the proximate idea of measurement to a symbolic idea almost immediately. And we think the building up of this picture for the people of Zechariah's day was one, if you like, the initial encouragement to labour in the work of God's truth, but secondly, to recognise that the labour was greater than they could possibly imagine, if we could put it that way, that it was a greater labour than just the measuring of a particular breadth on a door or a platform or whatever it means, because they would have realised immediately that this was far greater and more extensive than just the measurements of the temple. You couldn't have a man measuring the width, length and breadth of a city. And if you've seen some of the paintings, there's a painting that the brother in Central did on it many, many years ago. He actually had painted Jerusalem as a city, and like a man or an angel, if you like, above it with a measuring. And it's completely disproportionate in the sense that the measuring angel is huge and towers over the city of Jerusalem, and as if he's measuring the city. And that's the kind of vision, in a sense, perhaps, that Zechariah might have been able to portray to the people. So that the vision that he was going to show them was, yes, designed to encourage them in the proximate labour that they had, but also to realise that God's purpose is far greater than that. And that despite their individual obstacles, God had a much greater purpose with the city as a whole. And I think we might develop this as we're going through this second chapter, it would become apparent, and Brother David has actually given us an indication of that in his remarks, it would become apparent that the labour they were engaged in was not the final consummation. Because I don't know whether you've thought about it, brothers and sisters, but when these people came back from Babylon and they would have had these various visions, would some of them have thought that this would have been the consummation of God's purpose? I mean, the prophecies of Isaiah and the various other parts of the scripture which point forward to the purpose of God on earth, would they have thought that this, now the return from Babylon, would have been the final part of God's purpose? Perhaps some of them did think that. Perhaps some of them didn't think anything at all and were quite indifferent to these things. But for the thinking mind, and we'll try to bring this out, perhaps, to the thinking mind, there were certain details given and circumstances which would have given indication, and Brother David has said this, so I will be repeating myself somewhat. There were indications that, no, this wasn't the final consummation of God's purpose. So, what was the purpose then for this vision? Well, we said, yes, it would have been an obvious encouragement to the people who were labouring at that time. But the purpose really is given in verse 4. He says, "Run, speak to this young man, saying, Jerusalem shall be inhabited as towns without walls for the multitude of men and cattle therein." So, this almost seems the purpose that the measuring angel was going forth to do. Jerusalem shall be inhabited as towns without walls for the multitude of men and cattle therein. So Zechariah sees this man with a measuring line in his hand. What are you going to do? I'm going to measure Jerusalem. What's the purpose? The purpose ultimately is that Jerusalem shall be inhabited as towns without walls for the multitude of men and cattle therein. Now, they were building walls. Think about that as a kind of contradiction, if you like. We just said that you were the people knee-deep in dirt and mud and everything else, actually labouring against the odds to build. They were going to build the temple wall, and although they weren't doing it that point in time, they were actually going to build a city wall. And yet in verse 4, we read the angel who had met the other angel, who was the informative angel, if you like, says that Jerusalem's going to be inhabited as towns without walls for the multitude of men and cattle therein. So I wonder how the people would have received that. I wonder how Zechariah initially would have received that. They're going to build walls, everything is about building, and here Jerusalem is going to be inhabited as towns without walls. Now we know what walls are intended to do, and I know we're kind of like stretching our thoughts a little bit away from the temple, because that was the main thought, the main construction here at this time was the building of the temple that Haggai and Zechariah really got the people going to complete. But ultimately, you know, you'd have this, difficult to imagine perhaps, but when the temple was complete, as Brother Ewan pointed out to us in Ezra last night, you know, surrounding it, there was probably still a lot of building material left over, and still a lot of rubble and stuff that needed to be removed, as Nehemiah was told, which he found really discouraging. So, the words are now told, well, we're not going to build Jerusalem. It's going to be built without walls. It's going to be inhabited, rather, without walls. So, walls, really, we know in the scripture, are usually built for protection. That's what they were intended to do. The cities, we remember, in the land of Canaan before Israel occupied it, presented a formidable picture to the 10 faithless spies, because the cities were walled up to heaven. They were their defences. In those days, they didn't depend upon the modern weapons that we have today. It was literally a wall of defence. And we're quite familiar, aren't we, with that phrase, a wall of defence. So, normally you would build a city to have this wall of defence. That's what walls are intended to do. But here we are given the indication that Jerusalem is going to be inhabited without walls. And there's going to be a multitude of men and cattle therein. If we look back at chapter 1, which David's drawn our attention to in verse 17, it says, "Cry yet, saying, Thus saith Yahweh Sabaoth, my city's true prosperity shall yet be spread abroad. And Yahweh shall yet comfort Zion, and shall yet choose Jerusalem again." So Zechariah has already been told this in chapter 1, and it's elaborated in chapter 2. We have a picture of expansion and prosperity and a situation which does not need the normal construction of defence. It doesn't need that. It's built without walls. And of course you and I know what ultimately that is pointing forward to. It's pointing forward to, isn't it, the time when there wouldn't be the Sanballats and the Tobias and the Horonites. There wouldn't be the oppositions and things to need a defensive system. If we were to translate that in today's language, there wouldn't be Syria or Iraq or Russia or any of the other host of Israel's enemies. And Israel were going to be blessed with prosperity. So what of this measuring line then? What would it actually symbolise to Zechariah? Now, as Brother David indicated to us, in chapter 1 and verse 16 we read, "Therefore thus saith Yahweh, and return to Jerusalem with mercies, My house shall be built in it, said Yahweh Sabaoth, and a line shall be stretched forth upon Jerusalem. And that word line there is the word quav. I'm not quite sure if that's how you pronounce it. But the concordance definition is that it's a cord, especially used for measuring. And Brother David said that it not so much measuring out cubit by cubit by cubit, but to have a specific definite extent. Now that really is the kind of idea that is provided for us. I don't think we're too distant away from the idea of measuring, and certainly it wouldn't have been too distant from the minds of Zechariah and those who were building. They would have looked very much to the implementation of their standard reed and the cubits as they built the various things that needed to be built in and around the temple. But in chapter 2, the word line or measuring line in verse 1 is actually a different word. And it's the word, I'll try this one, cable, or cable. And actually, according to Strong in his concordance, means a twisted rope. A twisted rope. Now, the use of that word in Scripture is kind of interesting. And if we could just keep our fingers in Zechariah, because we will come back to it. If we have a look at 2 Samuel chapter 8. 2 Samuel chapter 8. And if you look at verse 1, it says, after this it came to pass that David smote the Philistines and subdued them, and David took Metheg armor out of the hand of the Philistines, and he smote Moab and measured them with a line. And that word line there is the same word that's used in Zechariah 2. But notice what David does with it. He says he measured them with a line, casting them down to the ground, even with two lines measured he to put to death, and with one full line to keep alive. And so the Moabites became David's servants and brought gifts. Now, I'm not quite sure how David would have done this with this measuring line, or whatever he was used to keep some of the Moabites alive, and some of them were put to death. What is indicative in that verse is that this particular line was associated with a judgment that David was going to inflict upon the Moabites. Turn back to Amos this time in chapter 7. Where we get sort of towards the ideas of measure, or you get the idea of the kind of a plumb line, if you look at verse 7, Amos 7, verse 7. Then he showed me, and behold, Yahweh stood upon a wall made by a plumb line with a plumb line in his hand. But then in verse 17 it says, therefore thus saith Yahweh, thy wife shall be as an harlot of the city, and thy sons and thy daughters shall fall by the sword, and thy land shall be divided by line. And thou shalt die in a polluted land, and Israel shall surely go into captivity forth with his land. Now that line there is the same word, verse 17, as we find in chapter 2. And the idea that comes from it is that it's a line or unit of measurement, not so much for working out the difference between one point and another, but for producing the idea of punishment. Now, we've got then this idea then that there's a measuring line. This cable is the word. This, if it means literally a twisted rope, which has an idea of judgment associated with that word, measuring Jerusalem. So we've got this unit of measurement which is associated with judgment applied to Jerusalem. And when we think about the idea associated with this, we conclude that Jerusalem must stand not just for the city, but for Israel as a whole. And that there would be judgment upon Jerusalem. Now, of course, judgment had been brought upon Jerusalem. And chapter 1 gave an indication of the reasons why judgment had come. In the first 6 verses, Zechariah is told why judgment had come upon them. Your fathers, where are they? And the prophets, do they live forever? In verse 5, Verse 6, but my words and my statutes which I commanded my servants, the prophets, they did not take hold of your fathers, and they returned and said, like as Yahweh surveyor thought to do unto us according to our ways and according to doing so hath he dealt with us. God dealt with them because they had been disobedient. Now, there was then, in this vision that Zechariah was given, this idea of blessing, because Jerusalem was going to be inhabited as towns without walls, but this aspect of judgment, if we understand this Hebrew word correctly, which certainly looking at Amos and Samuel was applied with an idea of judging someone, we've got these two kind of ideas associated. We've got this vision, which we've said must take it out of the proximate time in which Zechariah was living, to a time of great blessing, but there was this measuring judgment which was to come upon Jerusalem. Now then, your minds have probably already run before me of what we are presenting, because Brother David has indicated to us the future purpose of God, and we know the future purpose of God from our studies of the scriptures. But just remind ourselves, Brother David talked about the man with the myrtle trees, which he took us right into the future, when the multitudinous man will subdue the nations and are at rest. So the first vision that Zechariah is given is kind of the nations at rest at the time of tabernacles. The myrtle, as David indicated, was one of the trees that was used in tabernacles. And I think what we may be seeing in Zechariah is what we see in other parts of Scripture, like the book of Revelation, and like various other parts, where an initial vision transports you into the future, and then you go back into the past to consider the details which lead up to it. So that, for example, Zechariah is shown the time when the nations are at rest and there's peace on the earth, then he's given the four horns, and you're immediately taken back through history to the four nations which Brother David brought out in Daniel chapter 2 and 7, which would have resulted in the downtreading of Israel as the years went by. But then the four carpenters take you back into the future, to the time when the horn powers would be subdued, and the carpenter, the Lord Jesus Christ and his associates would bring about the judgments on those who had afflicted Israel. In a sense, in chapter 2, in this initial vision that's given, we have our minds brought back, not always right historically back, but to a link which takes us to the time in when Zechariah is living, right through to the time of future blessings. Because in a sense, the measuring line was the joining period between Zechariah's day and the time when the blessings that Brother David spoke of would become a reality in the earth. This is the period which spans the centuries, if you like. This measuring line, if you like, as you would imagine, you would measure one point and another point. The point in time that Zechariah was seeing was his day, and the end of that measuring tape or line would be when the blessings would be fulfilled. That's what was being measured. That was what Zechariah was being shown. He was being shown that there would be a period of downtreading. There would be a period when there would be this judgment. But, like every measurement, it will have a starting point and it will have an end point. It's a bit like, in a sense, the measuring line to me, in a sense, reminds me of the outpouring of the seals and then the trumpets and the vials and the thunders in the apocalypse. It takes you through the measured times of the Gentiles, the apocalyptic times. So too this measuring line was going to extend as a period of judgment upon Israel until the time of future blessing, which the rest of the chapter speaks of. Now the inspiring fact that would have been presented here is that there would be an end. And you know, Brother Thomas in Eureka, he says the fortunes of the city, that's how he phrases this third vision. He said, the fortunes of the city were not abandoned to accident or caprice. because there was this man with a measuring line. He was very carefully measuring the vicissitudes of God's people. He was actually ensuring that the length and breadth were accurate. That's what he was going forth to do. What is the breadth thereof and what is the length thereof? It's been suggested, and I think with some warrant, that the breadth and the length could represent the extent and the duration would have a limited period of time. So that Zechariah is not given the length of this reed, the length of this measure. He's not said it's so many reeds. It would be interesting if he was given if it was like 20 reeds and you could work out some chronological framework. It's not given that, and Brother Thomas makes that reference in Eureka, that he wasn't given that. It was waited till the apocalyptic revelation to Jesus Christ before those times would be given. But what we are ensured of in this vision, and this would have been and certainly to a man like Zechariah and Haggai, it would have been a great encouragement that even though there was going to be further judgments, there would come an end, and the judgments would also have a limiting effect in themselves. So that, as Jeremiah said, though he make a full end of all nations whither I have driven thee, yet will I not make a full end of thee. So the extent, and even though when we look at Jewry throughout the centuries, we've seen terrible afflictions upon them, even in relatively recent times in the Second World War, we must see it, that measuring angel, if you like, was still ensuring that there would only be a certain amount they would have to endure. It would be limited. And of course, Jewry, despite the fact that Hitler wanted to annihilate them, he didn't succeed. So the extent of that judgment was still limited. And the final breadth, if you like, or length, whichever way you might want to look at it, would come to a point in time when it would finally come to an end. And that was the appointed time. To return our thoughts then to this aspect of, was this the final consummation? Did people think? There were a few things that really, if the discerning mind would have to come to a conclusion that this isn't the final part of God's plan and purpose before Messiah would manifest himself and build the temple. All the details were there in type as we work through the chapters of Zechariah, but that time was not going to be there. And there's a few reasons which we might want to consider. The first is, as we've considered, there were still adversaries. If the judgment on Israel had reached its end measurement point, there would be no more adversaries. The second point, they themselves, if they'd listened carefully to Daniel's words and Daniel's prophecies, would realize that those time periods did not fit into small chunks of time and must represent longer periods of time. Now, true it is, as Peter says, the prophets searched diligently into what things, let me just quote it exactly, the prophets searched what or what manner of time the Spirit of Christ which was in them did signify when it testified beforehand the sufferings of Christ and the glory that should follow. So the prophets would have been looking carefully and struggling to work it all out. But they would have realized, as Daniel realized, there were 6 certain days, that there was a long period of downtreading to go. It must extend, that measurement must extend further than the days of these returned captives. Thirdly, the as Brother David indicated, actually, they were subject to the little horn. The second horn, the Persian horn. They were in that, if there were 4 horns in that Zechariah saw in chapter 1, verse 18, then they would have identified Babylon as the first and Persia as the second. There was the third and fourth yet to come. And not only that, even then they were subject to Persian rule. As Brother David said, it was a much more lenient kind of rulership, but it was Persia, as Brother Ewan brought out to us last night, that actually stopped for a period of 15 years the building of the wall. The letter of authority came from the king, and the work ceased. So things were not really good. But perhaps the most interesting, or maybe the most profound point, were the people themselves. The people themselves were far from perfect. The ideas that present themselves in these visions was the time of great blessing and faithfulness. The people themselves had to be, as we considered last night, roused from their apathetic position. Let us arise and build was the kind of the theme of Nehemiah, a little bit after these days, of course, but then rose up Zechariah and Haggai to stir up the people. And it must have been clear, I think, to the mind of someone like Zechariah and Haggai and Ezra, Zerubbabel and Joshua, and as the time went forward to the days of Nehemiah, it must have been quite apparent that things were not so good at all. Because we know in the book of Ezra, they married strange wives. We know in the book of Nehemiah, they married strange wives and had Sanballat or the Horonite actually brought into the temple confines. And when we come to the book of Malachi, there's severe judgments upon the people of Israel, which was contemporary with Nehemiah. So the people themselves were not in that position that these visions project. It still had the hallmark then, this building activity still had the hallmark of fallible, weak, mortal man. The vision did present a vision of encouragement, but the faithful would have been looking at this and projecting their minds into the future, because the visions show a complete reversal of Gentile ascendancy. The Gentiles would not be ruling over them. They would not be able to stop the building. There would be no opposition. Once that measuring line had come to its end, had run its course, blessings would be poured out. And those blessings we have from verse 5 to the end of the chapter. Because although we've said, kind of like flipping ideas here, they're building walls, but this vision says Jerusalem's going to be inhabited without walls, there would be a wall, as verse 5 tells us. For I, saith Yahweh, would be unto her a wall of fire round about, and would be the glory in the midst of her. So, we have the means whereby this protection and these blessings are received by the people of Israel when that measuring line comes to an end. The protection is now given specifically by Yahweh himself, who becomes to the people of Israel a wall of fire. And that will become more apparent after their emancipation from the Russian onslaught. We know that the people of Israel today are still in the position that brought about their captivity in the days of Babylon and in the days of the Romans. Even though we are all roused up by the activities of the people of Israel today, we recognize that they're not faithful to God. That even their pioneers who built up present-day Israel were atheistic and secular. They were not godly. And Israel depends upon their own arm of the flesh. So that judgment line will have to extend just a little bit further until it comes to an end with the destruction of Russia, and that will be the turning point. That will be the end, because from that point onwards, when the rainbowed angel comes from the east across and through the valley of Achor, which now becomes a door of hope, then that measuring will have come to an end, and the Jewish fortunes will turn about, as it were. Then Yahweh will be unto her a wall of fire. Now, a wall of fire was not something that was alien to the people of Israel. If they thought about it, and no doubt Zechariah did, Haggai, whatever, many others, this wall of fire was something that started off the nation. The very nation began with a wall of fire around it. They came out of Egypt, you remember, and there was a wall of fire which separated them and the Egyptians. And fire, we know that in Scripture, has a sort of a two-fold effect. One, it's a destructive force, as we know, but we don't experience fire really as a protection. But Israel experienced it as a protection. The pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night was more than a protection for Israel. The Egyptians were kept well away from them, as we read in Exodus 14, verse 24. But that fire had also been a destructive force to the Egyptians. In the seventh plague, it said fire ran along the ground. So the aspect of fire is twofold. It can be destructive or protective. It destroyed Egypt, along with other plagues. It protected Israel. And so it will be seen in the future. The name of Yahweh, we read in Isaiah 30, verse 20, cometh from afar, burning with his anger. It will be a destructive fire against the Gentiles once again. But to Israel, we have this wall of fire. Let's have if we keep our fingers there in Zechariah, because we want to come back there, but just have a quick look at Isaiah chapter 4. Because we talk about the fire, there will be a wall of fire round about, and will be the glory in the midst of her. So Yahweh is saying here that when this measuring line comes to its end, Yahweh's going to be building the city himself, as it were, and will be a wall of fire, and will be the glory in the midst of her. Now, when you turn in Isaiah 4, if you remember, and we've done this very, very recently in Ezekiel, in chapters 8, 9, 10, and 11, we read a detailed account of the glory of God departing from Israel. The glory was initially seen in that wonderful cherubic vision in chapter 1. But then Ezekiel, because of Israel's apostasy, sees it going by way of the east, over the Mount of Olives, and sees it departing. Now then, even though this temple might have been very great that was being built on the return from the captivity, the one thing that did not exist in it was God's glory. The Shekinah glory, the word Shekinah means dwelling, Shekan, to dwell, and we use this kind of phrase, Shekinah glory, to indicate the glory that filled the tabernacle and it filled Solomon's temple, so that the priests had to go out when the glory came in. And Ezekiel sees this glory depart in the symbolic vision that he sees in Ezekiel. He sees it depart. Even though they came back and built this temple, that glory did not return. There was no glory. It was almost empty in its most holy place. But Zechariah in his vision says that when that measuring comes to an end, not only is it going to be a wall of fire, but the glory of Yahweh is going to be in the middle of Israel. And it's almost as if you have a change of figure from building a temple to building a people, to building a land. The glory of Yahweh kind of dwells now in the land as a whole. Or possibly the idea is within that holy oblation, which Ezekiel speaks about in, I think it's chapter 48. But anyway, we're in Isaiah 4. If we have a look just very, very quickly, in verse 4, for the context, when Yahweh shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion, and shall have purged the blood of Jerusalem from the midst thereof by the spirit of judgment and by the spirit of burning. Now that in context, notice again, this kind of gives us the same idea that Jerusalem is synonymous with the people as a whole. Because we know that God's not just going to purge the literal stones of Jerusalem. He's going to purge his people. So when Yahweh has washed the filth of the daughters of Zion, and shall have purged the blood of Jerusalem from the midst thereof by the spirit of judgment and by the spirit of burning, and Yahweh will create upon every dwelling place of Mount Zion and upon her assemblies a cloud and smoke by day and the shining of a flaming fire by night. For upon all the glory shall be a defense. All the glory shall be a defense. So we kind of have these ideas presented to us in other parts of the scripture. Here we have the idea that right in the temple that would be built in the midst, and we've got this idea of a cloud and and fire, the shining of a flaming fire by night, and upon all the glory shall be a defense or a canopy, a covering. So we've kind of got the same idea. And we wonder whether when Zechariah would have presented this idea in verse 5 to the people, whether their minds would have gone to Isaiah's prophecy and started to think about the temple. And the faithful probably would have recognized that although they were literally building the temple that at that time, then really it was going to be only typical of the greater temple that would be built, and which Ezekiel had already spoken of when he was in with the captives by the river of Kibar, and when that temple would be built with all its glory and beauty. Because if we turn to Ezekiel chapter 43, I can see your time is going, but Ezekiel chapter 43, we find that when that glory does return, it's not just as a physical glory, as an eminence of radiant power that prevented the high priest from entering the most holy place unless he had the incense burning. And when the priests in the time of Solomon had to leave the confines of the temple when the glory of Yahweh came in, we find that when it returns, it's embodied in a multitude. And Brother David has spoken to us about that in the first couple of visions in chapter 1. Verse 1 of chapter Ezekiel 43, "Afterwards he brought me to the gate, even the gate that looketh toward the east. And behold, the glory of the Elohim of Israel came from the way of the east, and his voice was like the noise of many waters, and the earth shined with his glory. And it was according to the appearance of the vision which I saw, even according to the vision that I saw when I came to destroy the city. And the visions were like the vision that I saw by the river Kibar. And I fell upon my face. And the glory of Yahweh came into the house by the way of the east, the gate whose prospect is toward the east. So the Spirit took me up and brought me into the inner court, and behold, the glory of Yahweh filled the house, and I heard him speak unto me out of the house, and the man stood by me. And he said, Son of man, the place of my throne and the place of the soles of my feet, where I will dwell in the midst of the children of Israel forever," and so on. But in verse 2, this glory was as the noise of many waters. Now we know waters symbolize a multitude, because it's made up of hundreds and thousands of water droplets. And as an immense conglomeration of water, it would indicate, as Brother David indicates, the multitudinous Son of Man. It's the vision of the saints who now come to Zion and come by the way of the east. You know that the Euphrates, as the Apocalypse chapter 16 says, is being dried up, that the way out of the kings out of the sun's rising must come. And that's the same idea that we have here, that the glory of the Elohim of Israel now returns after this extended period of judgment comes to the people of Israel as a wall of fire and the glory in the midst of her. A couple of verses, if we could, look at Isaiah chapter 60. Isaiah chapter 60, I know David went to Isaiah a couple of times because it does show the restoration, and what David's chapter and the chapter we're considering here is showing to us is looking at the restoration. I was only thinking earlier that our hope is the hope of Israel, isn't it? Verse 1 of chapter 60, "Arise, shine, for thy light is come, and the glory of Yahweh is risen upon thee. For behold, the darkness shall cover the earth, and gross darkness the people. But Yahweh shall arise upon thee, and his glory shall be seen upon thee." So the glory is there presented to us when the light of the rainbowed angel comes upon Israel. If we look quickly at verse 15, we read, "Whereas thou hast been forsaken and hated, so that no man went through thee, I will make thee an eternal excellency, a joy of many generations." In the words of Zechariah chapter 2, the "whereas thou hast been forsaken and hated," that measuring line now has come to an end. That period has ended. The period of judgment which God has brought upon his people has come to an end. Verse 18, "Violence shall no more be heard in thy land, wasting nor destruction within thy borders, but thou shalt call thy walls salvation." And again, not bricks and mortar or stone, the walls is called salvation, and thy gates praise. Our minds are elevated from the natural. Of course, they will be literal walls, but our minds are being lifted by the prophecy of Isaiah to consider the glorious principles of the truth that have been presented to us. The sun shall be no more thy light by day, neither the brightness shall the moon give light unto thee, but Yahweh shall be unto thee an everlasting light, and thy Elohim thy glory. Verse 21, thy people also shall be all righteous. They shall inherit the land forever. The branch of my planting and the work of my hands. My people shall be all righteous. It became painfully obvious to the times of Haggai, Zechariah, Nehemiah, that the people weren't all righteous. That although that vision in Zechariah was a glorious one, it was imperfect when the details were examined. And so, our minds then in Zechariah, if we could turn back to Zechariah chapter 2 again, we find that prophetically, Israel was now called upon to flee and come out from the land of the north. Verse 6, Ho, come forth and flee from the land of the north. Now, they'd come from the land of the north. And again, this is another kind of indication that there was something about these visions which was transporting the mind into the future. Although, as we've tried to indicate, there would have been a lot of comfort, a lot of encouragement from these visions, there were certain other things which the prophet was being told that indicated that the final restoration, the final glory was in the future. Ho, ho, come forth, flee from the land of the north. They'd already come from the land of the north. To the Israelite here, the land of Babylon was the land of the north, if any land was going to be at that time, because they would have come down from the north and taken them into the captivity, not coming straight across the deserts. So verse 6, and actually from verses 6 to 9, it's like an invitation to Israel, which is in the future. And we need to speed up a little bit now to go through this, to get the idea, because I think there's about 4 or 5 points which indicates the time of the end and builds upon the apocalyptic picture that we are looking forward to seeing at the time of the end, because we're still in that measuring period. We haven't come to the end of it. Ho, ho, come forth, flee from the land of the north, saith Yahweh, for I have spread you abroad as the four winds of the heaven, saith Yahweh. Well, we think, if we haven't got time to go through it now, but if we had to look at Malachi chapter 4, verses 5 to 6, and the prophecy of Ezekiel chapter 39, and looked at some of the verses from 25 to 26, we see the work of Elijah and the work of gathering. We actually heard a tape by Brother Grocott yesterday, which was the basis of his address in volume 2 of Be Transformed, the last terrible 40 years. It's expanded quite somewhat, and he basically suggests, if I understood him correctly, that the nations at the time of this great judgment of Armageddon, when Russia is destroyed and Christ appears in the land, that the nations will try to hold on to the Jews as hostages, which I thought was an interesting thought, because we read, and I haven't got the verse down, I don't think, but it says, I will say to the north, give up, and to the south, keep not back, bring my sons from far. It appears as if the nations will try to hold on to the Jews, to try and use them as hostages. But it will be no good, because the work of Elijah will actually bring them forth, as we know. So the lands of the north could refer in the future to the land of Russia, where many Jews are still living, of course. But the four winds that's referred to would indicate the universal scattering of the people of Israel, who will actually come back. But look at the verse 7. Deliver thyself, O Zion, that dwellest with the daughter of Babylon. They were very familiar with Babylon. So all the ideas in the chapter are linking them with approximate events that had taken place. But prophetically looking, deliver thyself. The Revised Version renders that, Ho Zion, escape thou. And we cannot help making that conclusion with Apocalypse chapter 18, verse 4, where the words go, we believe, to the Jews, come out of her, my people, that he be not partaker of her sins. So I think the time period we're looking at here is from the destruction of Russia, and when it says, I will be a wall of fire and I will be the glory in the midst of her, in a sense, the rainbowed angel comes in. And then the details in verse 5 is an announcement to go to Ho, come forth from the land of the north. and deliver yourself from Catholic Europe. Babylon there is the mystical Babylon that we read about in Apocalypse chapter 17. You know that, and the exhortation to the Jews was to leave there. Deliver thyself, O Zion, escape from her, because you're going to be destroyed with her if you stay there. And you know, you can't help thinking about Nazi Germany in the Second World War. Those Jews, and we know there were some in Central who we were familiar with, who actually fled Nazi Germany, escaped and saved their lives. Those who kept hold of the flesh pots that Germany offered them perished. And we wonder whether this other time when the work of Elijah will go forth and it will say, come out of her, my people, that he be not partaker of her sins, will they, one, be impressed by what had happened, perhaps in living memory to some of them in Nazi Germany, and the work that Elijah and the miracles he will show them, my people will be willing in the day of thy glory. That's not quite the quotation of Psalm 110, but you know the one I mean. So deliver thyself is a huge exhortation to deliver themselves, just like they had done in delivering themselves from Babylon, because many probably didn't. Many probably stayed in Babylon because they were having a good time there, perhaps. Who'd want to sort of throw in your lot and go back to a dust-risen desert with no city? It took faith to go back with Ezra and Zerubbabel. So again, it will take faith on God's people to throw in their lot, maybe, with the people of with Elijah and God's people at that time. Because in verse 8, the Aeonian gospel is being proclaimed. Thus says Yahweh surveyeth, after the glory hath he sent me unto the nations which spoiled you. For he that toucheth you toucheth the apple of his eye. We notice that the word Yahweh surveyeth is there. That's the belligerent title of deity there. This is after Armageddon, I would suggest. After the glory hath he sent me. I think the idea is that after Russia is destroyed by the glory that destroys the host in Bozrah, now settled itself in the Holy Land. I would suggest that that's the time we're looking at when this announcement goes out along with the Aeonian gospel, to fear God and him who made the heavens and the earth and the fountains of water. It says, for he hath sent me unto the nations. The me there is, I think, is the multitudinous Son of Man. Because the universal declaration is there, he that toucheth you toucheth the apple of his eye. Russia dared come down into the land of Israel, and she perished, and they would be 7 months burying her dead. That's what would happen to those who touch God's people and his land. It would be like touching someone's eye, extremely sensitive, and that's how Yahweh depicts it there. The nations that spoiled you, Israel's fortunes now begin to be reversed. Brother David talked to us quite a bit about the fact in verse 15 of chapter 1, I'm very sore displeased with the heathen that are at ease. For I was but a little displeased, and they helped forward the affliction. Brother David has correctly indicated to us how God feels when his nation is being downtrodden and persecuted. But here we have the idea, when the nations are spoiled, now they are going to be spoiled. We had a series of quotations which we haven't got time to turn up. If anybody would like to write them down, they're welcome to do so. It's Isaiah 54, verses 1 to 2, 7 to 8, verses 14 and 17. And then we were going to have a quick look at Ezekiel 36, verse 24, 28, and 36 to 38. To see the reversal of affairs that comes with the glory coming in to Israel. And then also we have in verse 9 a warning for the nations. For behold, verse 9, I will shake mine hand upon them, and they shall be a spoil to their servants, and he shall know that Yahweh Sabaoth hath sent me. I think that will be a warning to the nations of the world. Yahweh is now the glory in the midst of Israel. He's the fire round about her. A warning will go forth. Kiss the sun, Psalm 2, lest he be angry with thee, and they'll perish a little. I can't remember it. You'll remember the quotation in Psalm 2, verses 10 to 12. Here's the idea. Shake in the hand. It's a very demonstrative expression. And we find it, and again, we haven't got time to look at it, but in Isaiah 11 verse 15 and Isaiah 19 verse 16, the same idea is there, shaking the hand. The roles are now reversed. they shall be a spoil to their servants. Basically, Israel has been the servant nation. Now they will be spoiled and they will become Israel's servant, and everyone will know, Israel will know that Yahweh Sabaoth has sent me, the end of verse 9. From verses 10 to verses 13, I would like to suggest, but I think the verses are open to other ideas as well, but I'd like to suggest that maybe we do have the climax of God's purpose there. Maybe our minds are projected even beyond the 30-year period when the daughter of Babylon is destroyed. Sing and rejoice, O daughter of Zion, for lo, I come and I will dwell in the midst of thee, saith Yahweh. Singing, an aspect of joy, isn't it? When we sing, it's a joyful experience. And there are various parts of the scriptures where singing is expressive of the time of Israel's restoration and glory. Isaiah chapter 12, verse 5. Zephaniah chapter 3 is a really interesting one, verses 14 to 17, which we haven't got time to look at now. But I will dwell in the midst of thee. We've looked a lot about the dwelling of the deity in his glory, as it would have been in the tabernacle and Solomon's temple. Now Yahweh is dwelling in the midst of Israel. We wanted to have a look at Psalm 132, verse 13 to 14. But the idea of fellowship with this dwelling is presented to us. You know, when the children of Israel were instructed to build a tabernacle in Exodus 25, it says that I may dwell amongst them. Although Yahweh holds people back from him so that there needs to be mediatorship, he still desires to dwell with man upon principles which man adheres to. Verse 11 of this chapter, many nations shall be joined to Yahweh in that day and shall be my people. And I will dwell in the midst of thee, and thou shalt know that Yahweh Sabaoth has sent me unto thee. So the nations as well are going to experience the blessing of Yahweh. So this well, I suggested that this must be fulfilled perhaps after the final judgment on the nations, because then all nations will be blessed in Abraham and his seed, to quote the words of Galatians chapter 3. Verse 12 we read, and Yahweh shall inherit Judah, his portion in the Holy Land, and shall choose Jerusalem again. Now that's interesting there, because it says, and Yahweh shall inherit Judah, his portion in the Holy Land. Why inherit Judah? Why does it say Yahweh shall inherit Judah? Why not Issachar? Why not Manasseh? Why not some of the other tribes? Well, the suggestion has been made, and it's really interesting, that in the cantons which are described to us in Ezekiel chapter 48, and we've got that picture that Brother Sonny presents in his book of the various tribes going, you know, east, west, or west, east, across the 300,000 square miles, we have the holy oblation in the middle, that 56 miles by 56 miles area. And it's suggested that that geographically is where the tribe of Judah originally was. So when Joshua inherited the land and the various tribes were mapped out, Judah would have had a particular part. The holy oblation, where the glory of Yahweh and Christ will reign victoriously, with the temple of Ezekiel describes, will be actually in that portion of Judah. So that in a sense, when it says Yahweh shall inherit Judah, his portion in the Holy Land, we find the details of Zechariah and Ezekiel agreeing, Yahweh inheriting that particular part, because Yahweh will dwell specifically in that particular area. Be silent then, O all flesh, before Yahweh, for he is raised up out of his holy habitation. I think that kind of does take us back a little to the general picture that will be presented. Be silent, O all flesh. An interesting idea associated with that. I'll just quickly quote to you from Isaiah chapter 17, where it says, the nations shall rush like the rushing of many waters, but God... I think I wanted the verse before. Yes, I did. Verse 12. Isaiah 17, verse 12, if you're making notes. It says, woe to the multitude of the people which make a noise, like the noise of the seas, and the rushing of nations that make a rushing, like the rushing of mighty waters. It's the great rushing of the Gorgian horse that will come down in the time of the end, the king of the north that comes down with a great noise. to tread down God's people and to think to establish themselves universal dominion. Be silent, O all flesh, says Yahweh, before me. Be silent. The noise of the nations, which are like the sea, which Isaiah says, the wicked are like a troubled sea, casting up mire and dirt, the noise that they make will be silenced. All flesh silenced before him, for he is raised up out of his holy habitation. What a wonderful picture. The time, I think, has well and truly gone, so I'm going to conclude with just a couple of thoughts. We're told in verse 1, behold, I lift up mine eyes and again and look, and behold a man with a measuring line. So he sees a man with a measuring line. Then in verse 3 he says, and behold the angel that talked with me. That seemed to be the angel that was talking to him in chapter 1, that was interpreting the various things to him. That's the second individual. Behold, the angel that talked to me went forth, and another angel went out to meet him. That's number 3. If you add Zechariah onto that, you've got number 4. The idea may be there that you've got this cherubic idea associated there. The man with the measuring line, the angel that talked with me, and another angel who some have suggested is a type of Christ. And this young man. That's been suggested that this young man, run to this young man, and that was Zechariah. And I'm not absolutely convinced of that, but there does seem to be 4 personages in that. And I did wonder whether there was any way of linking those 4 different roles in with the 4 cherubic faces, or the 4 different ways that Christ is manifested, perhaps. We know as a measuring line that Christ is certainly now supervising the affairs of the nations. That's just a thought that might occur to your minds and which we might want to think about. I think I'm going to end where I began, which is where Brother Ewan ended yesterday. The work of labour, activity. Brother David indicated to us the glorious picture that the visions present to us, and I think in the chapter 2 we have that glorious vision presented to us as well. From our perspective, we will either be part of those things or we will not. We will either be accepted or we'll be rejected. We probably need then to remember the same sort of exhortations that Zechariah was providing the people. We have much opposition, we have much trials, difficulties as individuals, labouring against the diabolos that each one of us bears. We have trials and tribulations from without. We need to work and labour and pick up our own measuring lines, as it were, and engage in divine activity, so that the vision, when it materializes, will incorporate us as well.